that I will not reproach you. You may be certain that I will be compassionate and true to you. You may be certain that I will save you at whatever cost. Oh, Tom, have you nothing to tell me? Whisper very softly. Say only yes, and I shall understand you." She turned her ear to his lips, but he remained doggedly silent. "Not a word, Tom? How can I say yes, or how can I say no, when I don't know what you mean? Lou, you are a brave, kind girl. Worthy, I begin to think, of a better brother than I am. But I have nothing more to say. Go to bed. Go to bed." "You are tired," she whispered presently, more in her usual way. "Yes, I am quite tired out. You have been so hurried and disturbed today. Have any fresh discoveries been made?" "Only those you have heard of from him." "Tom, have you said to anyone that we made a visit to those people, and that we saw those three together?" "No. Didn't you yourself particularly ask me to keep it quiet when you asked me to go there with you?" "Yes, but I did not know then what was going to happen."
"Nor I neither. How could I?"
He was very quick upon her with this retort. "Ought I to say, after what has happened," said his sister, standing by the bed. She had gradually withdrawn herself and risen. "That I made that visit. Should I say so? Must I say so?"
"Good heavens, Lou," returned her brother.
"You are not in the habit of asking my advice. Say what you like. If you keep it to yourself, I shall keep it to myself. If you disclose it, there's an end of it."
It was too dark for either to see the other's face, but each seemed very attentive and to consider before speaking.
"Tom, do you believe the man I gave the money to is really implicated in this crime?"
"I don't know. I don't see why I shouldn't be."
"He seemed to me an honest man."
"Another person may seem to you dishonest and yet not be so." There was a pause, for he had hesitated and stopped. "In short," resumed Tom, as if he had made up his mind, "if you come to that, perhaps I was so far from being altogether in his favour that I took him outside the door to tell him, quietly, that I thought he might consider himself very well off to get such a windfall as he had got from my sister, and that I hoped he would make good use of it. You remember whether I took him out or not? I say nothing against the man. He may be a very good fellow, for anything I know. I hope he is."
"Was he offended by what you said?"
"No, he took it pretty well. He was civil enough."
"Where are you, Lou?"
He sat up in bed and kissed her.
"Good night, my dear. Good night. You have nothing more to tell me?"
"No, what should I have? You wouldn't have me tell you a lie."
"I wouldn't have you do that tonight, Tom, of all the nights in your life. Many and much happier, as I hope they will be."
"Thank you, my dear Lou. I'm so tired that I'm sure I wonder I don't say anything to get to sleep.
Go to bed, go to bed."
Kissing her again, he turned round, drew the coverlet over his head, and lay as still as if that time had come by which she had adjured him. She stood for some time at the bedside, before she slowly moved away. She stopped at the door, looked back when she had opened it, and asked him if he had called her. But he lay still, and she softly closed the door and returned to her room. Then the wretched boy looked cautiously up and found her gone, crept out of bed, fastened his door, and threw himself upon his pillow again, tearing his hair, morosely crying, grudgingly loving her, hatefully but impenitently spurning himself, and no less hatefully and unprofitably spurning all the good in the world. Chapter 9. Hearing the Last of It. Mrs. Sparsit, lying by to recover the tone of her nerves in Mr. Bounderby's retreat, kept such a sharp lookout, night and day, under her Coriolanian eyebrows, that her eyes, like a couple of lighthouses on an iron-bound coast, might have warned all prudent mariners from that bold rock, her Roman nose, and the dark and craggy region in its neighbourhood, but for the placidity of her manner. Although it was hard to believe that her retiring for the night could be anything but a form, So severely wide awake were those classical eyes of hers, and so impossible did it seem that her rigid nose could yield to any relaxing influence. Yet her manner of sitting, smoothing her uncomfortable, not to say gritty, mittens — they were constructed of a cool fabric like a meat safe — or of ambling to unknown places of destination with her foot in her cotton stirrup, was so perfectly serene that most observers would have been constrained to suppose her a dove embodied by some freak of nature in the earthly tabernacle of a bird of the hook-beaked order. She was a most wonderful woman for prowling about the house. How she got from story to story was a mystery beyond solution. A lady so decorous in herself and so highly connected was not to be suspected of dropping over the banisters or sliding down them, yet her extraordinary facility of locomotion suggested the wild idea. Another noticeable circumstance in Mrs. Sparsit was that she was never hurried. She would shoot with consummate velocity from the roof to the hall, yet would be in full possession of her breath and dignity on the moment of her arrival there. Neither was she ever seen by human vision to go at a great pace. She took very kindly to Mr. Harthouse, and had some pleasant conversation with him soon after her arrival. She made him her stately curtsy in the garden one morning before breakfast.
"It appears but yesterday, sir," said Mrs. Sparsit, "that I had the honour of receiving you at the bank, when you were so good as to wish to be made acquainted with Mr. Bounderby's address. An occasion, I am sure, not to be forgotten by myself in the course of ages," said Mr. Harthouse, inclining his head to Mrs. Sparsit with the most indolent of all possible airs. "We live in a singular world, sir," said Mrs. Sparsit. "I have had the honour, by a coincidence of which I am proud, to have made a remark similar in effect, though not so epigrammatically expressed." "A singular world, I would say, sir," pursued Mrs. Sparsit, after acknowledging the compliment with a drooping of her dark eyebrows, not altogether so mild in its expression as her voice was in its dulcet tones, "as regards the intimacies we form at one time with individuals we were quite ignorant of at another. I recall, sir, that on that occasion you went so far as to say you were actually apprehensive of Miss Gradgrind."
"Your memory does me more honour than my insignificance deserves. I availed myself of your obliging hints to correct my timidity, and it is unnecessary to add that they were perfectly accurate. Mrs. Sparsit's talent for, in fact, for anything requiring accuracy, with a combination of strength of mind and family, is too habitually developed to admit of any question."
He was almost falling asleep over this compliment, it took him so long to get through, and his mind wandered so much in the course of its execution.
"You found Miss Gradgrind, I really cannot call her Mrs. Bounderby, it's very absurd of me, as youthful as I described her?" asked Mrs. Sparsit sweetly.
"You drew her portrait perfectly," said Mr. Harthouse.
"Presented her dead image." "Very engaging, sir," said Mrs. Sparsit,
causing her mittens slowly to revolve over one another.
"Highly so." "It used to be considered," said Mrs. Sparsit, "that Miss Gradgrind was wanting in animation, but I confess she appears to me considerably and strikingly improved in that respect." "Aye, and indeed here is Mr. Bounderby," cried Mrs. Sparsit,
nodding her head a great many times as if she had been talking and thinking of no one else.
"How do you find yourself this morning, sir? Pray let us see you cheerful, sir."
Now, these persistent assuagements of his misery and lightenings of his load had by this time begun to have the effect of making Mr. Bounderby softer than usual towards Mrs. Sparsit, and harder than usual to most other people from his wife downward. So when Mrs. Sparsit said, with forced lightness of heart,
"You want your breakfast, sir, but I dare say Miss Gradgrind will soon be here to preside at the table," Mr. Bounderby replied,
"If I waited to be taken care of by my wife, ma'am, I believe you know pretty well I should wait till doomsday. So I'll trouble you to take charge of the teapot."
Mrs. Sparsit complied, and assumed her old position at table. This again made the excellent woman vastly sentimental. She was so humble withal that when Louisa appeared, she rose, protesting she could never think of sitting in that place under existing circumstances, often as she had had the honour of making Mr. Bounderby's breakfast before Mrs. Gradgrind. She begged pardon. She meant to say Miss Bounderby. She hoped to be excused, but she really could not get it right yet, though she trusted to become familiar with it by and by, had assumed her present position. It was only, she observed, because Miss Gradgrind happened to be a little late, and Mr. Bounderby's time was so very precious, and she knew it of old to be so essential that he should breakfast to the moment, that she had taken the liberty of complying with his request, long as his will had been a law to her.
"There, stop where you are, ma'am," said Mr. Bounderby. "Stop where you are. Mrs. Bounderby will be very glad to be relieved of the trouble, I believe."
"Don't say that, sir," returned Mrs. Sparsit,
almost with severity,
"because that is very unkind to Mrs. Bounderby, and to be unkind is not to be you, sir."
"You may set your mind at rest, ma'am. You can take it very quietly, can't you, Lou?" said Mr. Bounderby in a blustering way to his wife.
"Of course, it is of no moment. Why should it be of any importance to me?"
"Why should it be of any importance to anyone, Mrs. Sparsit, ma'am?" said Mr. Bounderby, swelling with a sense of slight. "You attach too much importance to these things, ma'am. By George, you'll be corrupted in some of your notions here. You are old-fashioned, ma'am. You are behind Tom Gradgrind's children's time."
"What is the matter with you?"
asked Louisa, coldly surprised. "What has given you offence?"
"Offence?" repeated Bounderby. "Do you suppose if there was any offence given me I shouldn't name it and request to have it corrected? I am a straightforward man, I believe. I don't go beating about for side winds."
"I suppose no one has ever had occasion to think you too diffident or too delicate," Louisa answered him composedly. "I have never made that objection to you either as a child or as a woman. I don't understand what you would have."
"Have?" returned Mr. Bounderby. "Nothing. Otherwise, don't you, Lou Bounderby, know thoroughly well that I, Josiah Bounderby of Coketown, would have it?"
She looked at him as he struck the table and made the teacups ring, with a proud colour in her face that was a new change, Mr. Harthouse thought.
"You are incomprehensible this morning," said Louisa. "Pray take no further trouble to explain yourself. I'm not curious to know your meaning. What does it matter?"
Nothing more was said on this theme, and Mr. Harthouse was soon idly gay on indifferent subjects. But from this day, the Sparsit action upon Mr. Bounderby threw Louisa and James Harthouse more together, and strengthened the dangerous alienation from her husband and confidence against him with another, into which she had fallen by degrees so fine that she could not retrace them if she tried. But whether she ever tried or no, lay hidden in her own closed heart. Mrs. Sparsit was so much affected on this particular occasion that, assisting Mr. Bounderby to his hat after breakfast, and being then alone with him in the hall, she imprinted a chaste kiss upon his hand, murmured, "My benefactor," and retired, overwhelmed with grief. Yet it is an indubitable fact within the cognizance of this history that 5 minutes after he had left the house in the selfsame hat, the same descendant of the Scadgeses and connection by matrimony of the Powlers shook her right-hand mitten at his portrait, made a contemptuous grimace at that work of art, and said, "Serve you right, you noodle, and I am glad of it." Mr. Bounderby had not been long gone when Bitzer appeared. Bitzer had come down by train, shrieking and rattling over the long line of arches that bestrode the wild country of past and present coal pits, with an express from Stone Lodge. It was a hasty note to inform Louisa that Mrs. Gradgrind lay very ill. She had never been well within her daughter's knowledge, but she had declined within the last few days, had continued sinking all through the night, and was now as nearly dead as her limited capacity of being in any state that implied the ghost of an intention to get out of it allowed. Accompanied by the lightest of porters, fit, colourless servitor at death's door when Mrs. Gradgrind knocked, Louisa rumbled to Coketown, over the coal pits past and present, and was whirled into its smoky jaws. She dismissed the messenger to his own devices and rode away to her old home. She had seldom been there since her marriage. Her father was usually sifting and sifting at his parliamentary cinder heap in London, without being observed to turn up many precious articles among the rubbish, and was still hard at it in the National Dust Yard. Her mother had taken it rather as a disturbance than otherwise to be visited as she reclined upon her sofa. Young people Louisa felt herself all unfit for. Sissy she had never softened to again since the night when the stroller's child had raised her eyes to look at Mr. Bounderby's intended wife. She had no inducements to go back and had rarely gone. Neither as she approached her old home now did any of the best influences of old home descend upon her. The dreams of childhood, its airy fables, its graceful, beautiful, humane, impossible adornments of the world beyond, so good to be believed in once, so good to be remembered when outgrown, for then the least among them rises to the stature of a great charity in the heart, suffering little children to come into the midst of it and to keep with their pure hands a garden in the stony ways of this world, wherein it were better for all the children of Adam that they should oftener sun themselves, simple and trustful and not worldly wise. What had she to do with these? Remembrances of how she had journeyed to the little that she knew, by the enchanted roads of what she and millions of innocent creatures had hoped and imagined, of how, first coming upon reason through the tender light of fancy, she had seen it a beneficent god, deferring to gods as great as itself, not a grim idol, cruel and cold, with its victims bound hand to foot, and its big dumb shape set up with a sightless stare never to be moved by anything but so many calculated tons of leverage. What had she to do with these? Her remembrances of home and childhood were remembrances of the drying up of every spring and fountain in her young heart as it gushed out. The golden waters were not there. They were flowing for the fertilization of the land where grapes are gathered from thorns and figs from thistles. She went with a heavy, hardened kind of sorrow upon her into the house and into her mother's room. Since the time of her leaving home, Sissy had lived with the rest of the family on equal terms. Sissy was at her mother's side, and Jane, her sister, now 10 or 12 years old, was in the room. There was great trouble before it could be made known to Mrs. Gradgrind that her eldest child was there. She reclined, propped up from mere habit on a couch, as nearly in her old usual attitude as anything so helpless could be kept in. She had positively refused to take to her bed, on the ground that if she did, she would never hear the last of it. Her feeble voice sounded so far away in her bundle of shawls, and the sound of another voice addressing her seemed to take such a long time in getting down to her ears that she might have been lying at the bottom of a well. The poor lady was nearer truth than she ever had been, which had much to do with it. On being told that Mrs. Bounderby was there, she replied at cross purposes that she had never called him by that name since he married Louisa, that pending her choice of an objectionable name, she had called him Jay, and that she could not at present depart from that regulation, not being yet provided with a permanent substitute. Louisa had sat by her for some minutes and had spoken to her often before she arrived at a clear understanding who it was. She then seemed to come to it all at once.
"Well, my dear," said Mrs. Gradgrind, "and I hope you are going on satisfactorily to yourself. It was all your father's doing. He set his heart upon it, and he ought to know."
"I want to hear of you, Mother, not of myself."
"You want to hear of me, my dear? That's something new, I am sure, when anybody wants to hear of me. Not at all well, Louisa. Very faint and giddy."
"Are you in pain, dear Mother?"
I think there's a pain somewhere in the room," said Mrs. Gradgrind. "But I couldn't positively say that I have got it."
After this strange speech, she lay silent for some time. Louisa, holding her hand, could feel no pulse, but kissing it could see a slight thin thread of life in fluttering motion.
"You very seldom see your sister," said Mrs. Gradgrind. "She grows like you. I wish you would look at her. Sissy, bring her here."
She was brought, and stood with her hand in her sister's. Louisa had observed her with her arm round Sissy's neck, and she felt the difference of this approach.
Do you see the likeness, Louisa?
Yes, Mother. I should think her like me, but...
Eh? Yes, I always say so,
Mrs. Gradgrind cried with unexpected quickness.
And that reminds me. I want to speak to you, my dear. Sissy, my good girl, leave us alone a minute.
Louisa had relinquished the hand, had thought that her sister's was a better and a brighter face than hers had ever been, had seen in it, not without a rising feeling of resentment, even in that place and at that time, something of the gentleness of the other face in the room, the sweet face with the trusting eyes, made paler than watching and sympathy made it by the rich, dark hair. Left alone with her mother, Louisa saw her lying with an awful lull upon her face, like one who was floating away upon some great water, all resistance over, content to be carried down the stream. She put the shadow of a hand to her lips again and recalled her.
You were going to speak to me, Mother. Eh? Yes, to be sure, my dear. You know your father is almost always away now, and therefore I must write to him about it.
About what, Mother?
Don't be troubled. About what? You must remember, my dear, that whenever I have said anything on any subject, I have never heard the last of it, and consequently that I have long left off saying anything.
I can hear you, Mother. But it was only by dint of bending down to her ear and at the same time attentively watching the lips as they moved that she could link such faint and broken sounds into any chain of connection.
You learnt a great deal, Louisa, and so did your brother. Ologies of all kinds, from morning to night. If there is any ology left of any description that has not been worn to rags in this house, all I can say is I hope I shall never hear its name.
I can hear you, Mother, when you have strength to go on. This to keep her from floating away.
But there is something, not an ology at all, that your father has missed. Or forgotten, Louisa. I don't know what it is. I've often sat with Sissy near me and thought about it. I shall never get its name now. But your father may. It makes me restless. I want to write to him, to find out, for God's sake, what it is. Give me a pen. Give me a pen.
Even the power of restlessness was gone, except from the poor head, which could just turn from side to side. She fancied, however, that her request had been complied with, and that the pen she could not have held was in her hand. It matters little what figures of wonderful no-meaning she began to trace upon her wrappers. The hand soon stopped in the midst of them. The light that had always been feeble and dim behind the weak transparency went out. And even Mrs. Gradgrind emerged from the shadow in which man walketh and disquieteth himself in vain, took upon her the dread solemnity of the sages and patriarchs. Chapter 10. Mrs. Sparsit's Staircase. Mrs. Sparsit's nerves being slow to recover their tone, the worthy woman made a stay of some weeks in duration at Mr. Bounderby's retreat, where, notwithstanding her anchorite turn of mind based upon her becoming consciousness of her altered station, she resigned herself with noble fortitude to lodging, as one may say, in clover, and feeding on the fat of the land. During the whole term of this recess from the guardianship of the bank, Mrs. Sparsit was a pattern of consistency, continuing to take such pity on Mr. Bounderby to his face as is rarely taken on man, and to call his portrait a noodle to its face with the greatest acrimony and contempt. Mr. Bounderby, having got it into his explosive composition that Mrs. Sparsit was a highly superior woman to perceive that he had that general cross upon him in his deserts, for he had not yet settled what it was, and further that Louisa would have objected to her as a frequent visitor, if it had comported with his greatness that she should object to anything he chose to do, resolved not to lose sight of Mrs. Sparsit easily. So when her nerves were strung up to the pitch of again consuming sweetbreads in solitude, he said to her at the dinner table on the day before her departure, "I tell you what, ma'am, you shall come down here of a Saturday while the fine weather lasts, and stay till Monday." To which Mrs. Sparsit returned in effect, though not of the Mohammedan persuasion, "To hear is to obey." Now, Mrs. Sparsit was not a poetical woman, but she took an idea in the nature of an allegorical fancy into her head. Much watching of Louisa, and much consequent observation of her impenetrable demeanour, which keenly whetted and sharpened Mrs. Sparsit's edge, must have given her, as it were, a lift in the way of inspiration. She erected in her mind a mighty staircase, with a dark pit of shame and ruin at the bottom, and down those stairs, from day to day and hour to hour, she saw Louisa coming. It became the business of Mrs. Sparsit's life to look up at her staircase and to watch Louisa coming down. Sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly, sometimes several steps at one bout, sometimes stopping, never turning back. If she had once turned back, it might have been the death of Mrs. Sparsit in spleen and grief. She had been descending steadily to the day, and on the day when Mr. Bounderby issued the weekly invitation recorded above, Mrs. Sparsit was in good spirits and inclined to be conversational.
"And pray, sir," said she, "if I may venture to ask a question appertaining to any subject on which you show reserve, which is indeed hardy in me, for I well know you have a reason for everything you do. Have you received intelligence respecting the robbery?"
"Why, ma'am, no, not yet. Under the circumstances, I didn't expect it yet. Rome wasn't built in a day, ma'am."
"Very true, sir," said Mrs. Sparsit, shaking her head.
"Nor yet in a week, ma'am."
"No, indeed, sir," returned Mrs. Sparsit, with a gentle melancholy upon her.
"In a similar manner, ma'am," said Bounderby. "I can wait, you know. If Romulus and Remus could wait, Josiah Bounderby can wait. They were better off in their youth than I was, however. They had a she-wolf for a nurse. I had only a she-wolf for a grandmother. She didn't give any milk, ma'am. She gave bruises. She was a regular Alderney at that."
"Ah,"
Mrs. Sparsit sighed and shuddered.
"No, ma'am," continued Bounderby. "I've not heard anything more about it. It's in hand, though, and young Tom, who rather sticks to business at present, something new for him, he hadn't the schooling I had, is helping. My injunction is, keep it quiet and let it seem to blow over. Do what you like under the rose, but don't give a sign of what you're about, or half a hundred of them will combine together and get this fellow who has bolted out of reach for good. Keep it quiet, and the thieves will grow in confidence by little and little, and we shall have 'em."
"Very sagacious indeed, sir," said Mrs. Sparsit. "Very interesting. The old woman you mentioned, sir—"
"The old woman I mentioned, ma'am," said Bounderby, cutting the matter short, as it was nothing to boast about, "is not laid hold of. But she may take her oath she will be, if that is any satisfaction to her villainous old mind. In the meantime, ma'am, I am of opinion, if you ask me my opinion, that the less she is talked about, the better."
The same evening, Mrs. Sparsit, in her chamber window, resting from her packing operations, looked towards her great staircase and saw Louisa still descending. She sat by Mr. Harthouse in an alcove in the garden, talking very low. He stood leaning over her as they whispered together, and his face almost touched her hair.
"If not quite,"
said Mrs. Sparsit, straining her hawk's eyes to the utmost. Mrs. Sparsit was too distant to hear a word of their discourse, or even to know that they were speaking softly, otherwise than from the expression of their figures. But what they said was this:
"You recollect the man, Mr. Harthouse?"
"Oh, perfectly."
"His face and his manner and what he said?"
"Perfectly. And an infinitely dreary person he appeared to me to be, lengthy and prosy in the extreme. It was knowing to hold forth in the humble virtue school of eloquence, but I assure you I thought at the time, 'My good fellow, you are overdoing this.'" it has been very difficult for me to think ill of that man. My dear Louisa, as Tom says, which he never did say, you know no good of the fellow. No, certainly, nor of any other such person. How can I? She returned, with more of her first manner on her than he had lately seen, when I know nothing of them, men or women. My dear Louisa, then consent to receive the submissive representation of your devoted friend, who knows something of several varieties of his excellent fellow-creatures, for excellent they are, I'm quite ready to believe, in spite of such little foibles as always helping themselves to what they can get hold of. This fellow talks. Well, every fellow talks. He professes morality. Well, all sorts of humbugs profess morality. From the House of Commons to the House of Correction, there is a general profession of morality, except among our people. It really is that exception which makes our people quite reviving. You saw and heard the case. Here was one of the fluffy classes, pulled up extremely short by my esteemed friend Mr. Bounderby, who, as we know, is not possessed of that delicacy which would soften so tight a hand. The member of the fluffy classes was injured, exasperated, left the house grumbling, met somebody who proposed to him to go in for some share in this bank business, went in, put something in his pocket which had nothing in it before, and relieved his mind extremely. Really, he would have been an uncommon instead of a common fellow if he had not availed himself of such an opportunity. Or he may have originated it altogether, if he had the cleverness. I almost feel as though it must be bad in me, returned Louisa, after sitting thoughtful a while, to be so ready to agree with you, and to be so lightened in my heart by what you say. I only say what is reasonable, nothing worse. I've talked it over with my friend Tom more than once. Of course I remain on terms of perfect confidence with Tom, and he is quite of my opinion, and I am quite of his. Will you walk? They strolled away among the lanes beginning to be indistinct in the twilight, she leaning on his arm, and she little thought how she was going down, down, down Mrs. Sparsit's staircase. Night and day Mrs. Sparsit kept it standing. When Louisa had arrived at the bottom and disappeared in the gulf, it might fall in upon her if it would. But until then, there it was to be, a building before Mrs. Sparsit's eyes. And there Louisa always was upon it, and always gliding down, down, down. Mrs. Sparsit saw James Harthouse come and go. She heard of him here and there. She saw the changes of the face he had studied. She, too, remarked to a nicety how and when it clouded, how and when it cleared. She kept her black eyes wide open, with no touch of pity, with no touch of compunction, all absorbed in the interest of seeing her, ever drawing, with no hand to stay her, nearer and nearer to the bottom of this new giant's staircase. With all her deference for Mr. Bounderby, as contradistinguished from his portrait, Mrs. Sparsit had not the smallest intention of interrupting the descent. Eager to see it accomplished, and yet patient, she waited for the last fall as for the ripeness and fullness of the harvest of her hopes. Hushed in expectancy, she kept her wary gaze upon the stairs, and seldom so much as darkly shook her right mitten with her fist in it, at the figure coming down. Chapter 11. Lower and Lower. The figure descended the great stairs steadily, steadily, always verging like a weight in deep water to the black gulf at the bottom. Mr. Gradgrind, apprised of his wife's decease, made an expedition from London and buried her in a businesslike manner. He then returned with promptitude to the National Cinder Heap, and resumed his sifting for the odds and ends he wanted, and his throwing of the dust about into the eyes of other people who wanted other odds and ends. In fact, resumed his parliamentary duties. In the meantime,
Mrs. Sparsit kept unwinking watch and ward. Separated from her staircase all the week by the length of iron road dividing Coketown from the country house, she yet maintained her cat-like observation of Louisa through her husband, through her brother, through James Harthouse, through the outsides of letters and packets, through everything animate and inanimate that at any time went near the stairs.
"Your foot on the last step, my lady," said Mrs. Sparsit,
apostrophizing the descending figure with the aid of her threatening mitten,
"and all your art shall never blind me."
Art or nature, though, the original stock of Louisa's character, or the graft of circumstances upon it, her curious reserve did baffle, while it stimulated, one as sagacious as Mrs. Sparsit. There were times when Mr. James Harthouse was not sure of her. There were times when he could not read the face that he had studied so long, and when this lonely girl was a greater mystery to him than any woman of the world with a ring of satellites to help her. So the time went on, until it happened that Mr. Bounderby was called away from home by business which required his presence elsewhere for 3 or 4 days. It was on a Friday that he intimated this to Mrs. Sparsit at the bank, adding,
"But you'll go down tomorrow, ma'am, all the same. You'll go down just as if I was there. It will make no difference to you."
"Pray, sir," returned Mrs. Sparsit reproachfully, "let me beg you not to say that. Your absence will make a vast difference to me, sir, as I think you very well know."
"Well, ma'am, then you must get on in my absence as well as you can," said Mr. Bounderby, not displeased.
"Mr. Bounderby," retorted Mrs. Sparsit, "your will is to me a law, sir. Otherwise it might be my inclination to dispute your kind commands, not feeling sure that it will be quite so agreeable to Miss Gradgrind to receive me as it ever is to your own munificent hospitality. But you shall say no more, sir. I will go upon your invitation."
"Why, when I invite you to my house, ma'am," said Bounderby, opening his eyes, "I should hope you want no other invitation."
"No, indeed, sir," returned Mrs. Sparsit. "I should hope not. Say no more, sir. I would, sir, I could see you gay again."
"What do you mean, ma'am?" blustered Bounderby.
"Sir," rejoined Mrs. Sparsit, "there was wont to be an elasticity in you which I sadly miss. Be buoyant, sir."
Mr. Bounderby, under the influence of this difficult adjuration, backed up by her compassionate eye, could only scratch his head in a feeble and ridiculous manner, and afterwards assert himself at a distance by being heard to bully the small fry of business all the morning.
"Bitzer,"
said Mrs. Sparsit that afternoon, when her patron was gone on his journey and the bank was closing,
"present my compliments to young Mr. Thomas, and ask him if he would step up and partake of a lamb chop and walnut ketchup with a glass of India ale."
Young Mr. Thomas, being usually ready for anything in that way, returned a gracious answer and followed on its heels.
"Mr. Thomas," said Mrs. Sparsit, "these plain viands being on table, I thought you might be tempted."
"Thank ye, Mrs. Sparsit," said the whelp, and gloomily fell to.
"How is Mr. Harthouse, Mr. Tom?"
asked Mrs. Sparsit.
"Oh, he's all right," said Tom.
"Where may he be at present?"
Mrs. Sparsit asked in a light conversational manner, after mentally devoting the whelp to the Furies for being so uncommunicative.
"He is shooting in Yorkshire," said Tom. "Sent Lou a basket half as big as a church yesterday."
"The kind of gentleman, now," said Mrs. Sparsit sweetly, "whom one might wager to be a good shot."
"Crack," said Tom.
He had long been a down-looking young fellow, but this characteristic had so increased of late that he never raised his eyes to any face for 3 seconds together. Mrs. Sparsit consequently had ample means of watching his looks, if she were so inclined.
"Mr. Harthouse is a great favourite of mine," said Mrs. Sparsit, "as indeed he is of most people. May we expect to see him again shortly, Mr. Tom?"
"Why, I expect to see him tomorrow," returned the whelp.
"Good news," cried Mrs. Sparsit, blandly.
"I've got an appointment with him to meet him in the evening at the station here," said Tom.
and I'm going to dine with him afterwards, I believe. He's not coming down to the country house for a week or so, being due somewhere else. At least he says so. But I shouldn't wonder if he was to stop here over Sunday and stray that way.
Which reminds me, said Mrs. Sparsit, would you remember a message to your sister, Mr. Tom, if I was to charge you with one?
Well, I'll try, returned the reluctant whelp, if it isn't a long un.
It is merely my respectful compliments, said Mrs. Sparsit, and I fear I may not trouble her with my society this week, being still a little nervous and better perhaps by my poor self.
Oh, if that's all, observed Tom, it wouldn't much matter even if I was to forget it, for Lou's not likely to think of you unless she sees you. Having paid for his entertainment with this agreeable compliment, he relapsed into a hangdog silence until there was no more India ale left, when he said, Well, Mrs. Sparsit, I must be off, and went off. Next day, Saturday, Mrs. Sparsit sat at her window all day long looking at the customers coming in and out, watching the postman, keeping an eye on the general traffic of the street, revolving many things in her mind, but above all, keeping her attention on her staircase. The evening come, she put on her bonnet and shawl and went quietly out, having her reasons for hovering in a furtive way about the station by which a passenger would arrive from Yorkshire, and for preferring to peep into it round pillars and corners and out of ladies' waiting-room windows to appearing in its precincts openly. Tom was in attendance and loitered about until the expected train came in. It brought no Mr. Harthouse. Tom waited until the crowd had dispersed and the bustle was over, and then referred to a posted list of trains and took counsel with porters. That done, he strolled away idly, stopping in the street and looking up it and down it, and lifting his hat off and putting it on again, and yawning and stretching himself, and exhibiting all the symptoms of mortal weariness to be expected in one who had still to wait until the next train should come in, an hour and 40 minutes hence.
"This is a device to keep him out of the way," said Mrs. Sparsit,
starting from the dull office window whence she had watched him last.
"Harthouse is with his sister now."
It was the conception of an inspired moment, and she shot off with her utmost swiftness to work it out. The station for the country house was at the opposite end of the town. The time was short, the road not easy. But she was so quick in pouncing on a disengaged coach, so quick in darting out of it, producing her money, seizing her ticket and diving into the train, that she was borne along the arches spanning the land of coal pits past and present, as if she had been caught up in a cloud and whirled away. All the journey, immovable in the air, though never left behind, plain to the dark eyes of her mind as the electric wires which ruled a colossal strip of music paper out of the evening sky were plain to the dark eyes of her body, Mrs. Sparsit saw her staircase with the figure coming down. Very near the bottom now, upon the brink of the abyss. An overcast September evening, just at nightfall, saw beneath its drooping eyelids Mrs. Sparsit glide out of her carriage, pass down the wooden steps of the little station into a stony road, cross it into a green lane, and become hidden in a summer growth of leaves and branches. One or two late birds sleepily chirping in their nests, and a bat heavily crossing and recrossing her, and the reek of her own tread in the thick dust that felt like velvet, were all Mrs. Sparsit heard or saw, until she very softly closed a gate. She went up to the house, keeping within the shrubbery, and went round it, peeping between the leaves at the lower windows. Most of them were open, as they usually were in such warm weather, but there were no lights yet, and all was silent. She tried the garden, with no better effect. She thought of the wood, and stole towards it, heedless of long grass and briars, of worms, snails and slugs and all the creeping things that be. With her dark eyes and her hook nose warily in advance of her, Mrs. Sparsit softly crushed her way through the thick undergrowth, so intent upon her object that she probably would have done no less if the wood had been a wood of adders.
Hark! The smaller birds might have tumbled out of their nests, fascinated by the glittering of Mrs. Sparsit's eyes in the gloom, as she stopped and listened. Low voices, close at hand. His voice and hers. The appointment was a device to keep the brother away. There they were, yonder, by the felled tree. Bending low among the dewy grass, Mrs. Sparsit advanced closer to them. She drew herself up and stood behind a tree, like Robinson Crusoe in his ambuscade against the savages, so near to them that at a spring, and that no great one, she could have touched them both. He was there secretly, and had not shown himself at the house. He had come on horseback, and must have passed through the neighbouring fields, for his horse was tied to the meadow side of the fence within a few paces. "My dearest love," said he, "what could I do? Knowing you were alone, was it possible that I could stay away? You may hang your head to make yourself the more attractive. I don't know what they see in you when you hold it up," thought Mrs. Sparsit. "But you little think, my dearest love, whose eyes are on you." That she hung her head was certain. She urged him to go away. She commanded him to go away. But she neither turned her face to him nor raised it. Yet it was remarkable that she sat as still as ever the amiable woman in ambuscade had seen her sit at any period in her life. Her hands rested in one another like the hands of a statue, and even her manner of speaking was not hurried. "My dear child," said Harthouse. Mrs. Sparsit saw with delight that his arm embraced her. "Will you not bear with my society for a little while?" "Not here." "Where, Louisa?" "Not here." "But we have so little time to make so much of, and I have come so far, and I'm altogether so devoted and distracted. There never was a slave at once so devoted and ill-used by his mistress. To look for your sunny welcome that has warmed me into life, and to be received in your frozen manner, is heart-rending. Am I to say again that I must be left to myself here? But we must meet, my dear Louisa. Where shall we meet?"
They both started. The listener started guiltily, too, for she thought there was another listener among the trees. It was only rain, beginning to fall fast in heavy drops.
"Shall I ride up to the house a few minutes hence, innocently supposing that its master is at home and will be charmed to receive me?"
"No."
"Your cruel commands are implicitly to be obeyed, though I am the most unfortunate fellow in the world, I believe, to have been insensible to all other women, and to have fallen prostrate at last under the foot of the most beautiful, and the most engaging, and the most imperious. My dearest Louisa, I cannot go myself, or let you go in this hard abuse of your power."
Mrs. Sparsit saw him detain her with his encircling arm, and heard him then and there, within her, Mrs. Sparsit's greedy hearing, tell her how he loved her, and how she was the stake for which he ardently desired to play away all that he had in life. The objects he had lately pursued turned worthless beside her. Such success as was almost in his grasp he flung away from him like the dirt it was compared with her. Its pursuit, nevertheless, if it kept him near her, or its renunciation if it took him from her, or flight if she shared it, or secrecy if she commanded it, or any fate, or every fate, all was alike to him, so that she was true to him. The man who had seen how cast away she was, whom she had inspired at their first meeting with an admiration and interest of which he had thought himself incapable, whom she had received into her confidence, who was devoted to her and adored her. All this and more, in his hurry and in hers, in the whirl of her own gratified malice, in the dread of being discovered, in the rapidly increasing noise of heavy rain among the leaves and a thunderstorm rolling up, Mrs. Sparsit received into her mind, set off with such an unavoidable halo of confusion and indistinctness, that when at length he climbed the fence and led his horse away, she was not sure where they were to meet or when, except that they had said it was to be that night.
but one of them yet remained in the darkness before her, and while she tracked that one, she must be right.
"Oh, my dearest love," thought Mrs. Sparsit, "you little think how well attended you are."
Mrs. Sparsit saw her out of the wood and saw her enter the house. What to do next? It rained now in a sheet of water. Mrs. Sparsit's white stockings were of many colours, green predominating. Prickly things were in her shoes. Caterpillars slung themselves in hammocks of their own making from various parts of her dress. Rills ran from her bonnet and her Roman nose. In such condition, Mrs. Sparsit stood hidden in the density of the shrubbery, considering what next.
Lo, Louisa coming out of the house, hastily cloaked and muffled and stealing away. She elopes. She falls from the lowermost stair and is swallowed up in the gulf.
Indifferent to the rain and moving with a quick, determined step, she struck into a side path parallel with the ride. Mrs. Sparsit followed in the shadow of the trees at but a short distance, for it was not easy to keep a figure in view going quickly through the umbrageous darkness. When she stopped to close the side gate without noise, Mrs. Sparsit stopped. When she went on, Mrs. Sparsit went on. She went by the way Mrs. Sparsit had come, emerged from the green lane, crossed the stony road, and ascended the wooden steps to the railroad. A train for Coketown would come through presently, Mrs. Sparsit knew, so she understood Coketown to be her first place of destination. In Mrs. Sparsit's limp and streaming state, no extensive precautions were necessary to change her usual appearance, but she stopped under the lee of the station wall, tumbled her shawl into a new shape, and put it on over her bonnet. So disguised, she had no fear of being recognized when she followed up the railroad steps and paid her money in the small office. Louisa sat waiting in a corner. Mrs. Sparsit sat waiting in another corner. Both listened to the thunder, which was loud, and to the rain as it washed off the roof and pattered on the parapets of the arches. Two or three lamps were rained out and blown out, so both saw the lightning to advantage as it quivered and zigzagged on the iron tracks. The seizure of the station with a fit of trembling, gradually deepening to a complaint of the heart, announced the train. Fire and steam and smoke and red light. A hiss, a crash, a bell and a shriek. Louisa put into one carriage, Mrs. Sparsit put into another. The little station, a desert speck in the thunderstorm. Though her teeth chattered in her head from wet and cold, Mrs. Sparsit exulted hugely. The figure had plunged down the precipice, and she felt herself, as it were, attending on the body. Could she, who had been so active in the getting up of the funeral triumph, do less than exult?
"She will be at Coketown long before him," thought Mrs. Sparsit, "though his horse is never so good. Where will she wait for him, and where will they go together? Patience, we shall see."
The tremendous rain occasioned infinite confusion when the train stopped at its destination. Gutters and pipes had burst, drains had overflowed, and streets were under water. In the first instant of alighting, Mrs. Sparsit turned her distracted eyes towards the waiting coaches, which were in great request.
"She will get into one," she considered, "and will be away before I can follow in another. At all risks of being run over, I must see the number and hear the order given to the coachman."
But Mrs. Sparsit was wrong in her calculation. Louisa got into no coach and was already gone. The black eyes kept upon the railroad carriage in which she had travelled settled upon it a moment too late. The door not being opened after several minutes, Mrs. Sparsit passed it and repassed it, saw nothing, looked in, and found it empty. Wet through and through, with her feet squelching and squashing in her shoes whenever she moved, with a rash of rain upon her classical visage, with a bonnet like an overripe fig, with all her clothes spoiled, with damp impressions of every button, string, and hook and eye she wore, printed off upon her highly connected back, with a stagnant verdure on her general exterior, such as accumulates on an old park fence in a mouldy lane, Mrs. Sparsit had no resource but to burst into tears of bitterness and say,
"I have lost her!"
Chapter 12. Down. The National Dustmen, after entertaining one another with a great many noisy little fights among themselves, had dispersed for the present, and Mr. Gradgrind was at home for the vacation. He sat writing in the room with the deadly statistical clock, proving something, no doubt, probably in the main that the Good Samaritan was a bad economist. The noise of the rain did not disturb him much, but it attracted his attention sufficiently to make him raise his head sometimes, as if he were rather remonstrating with the elements. When it thundered very loudly, he glanced towards Coketown, having it in his mind that some of the tall chimneys might be struck by lightning. The thunder was rolling into distance, and the rain was pouring down like a deluge, when the door of his room opened. He looked round the lamp upon his table, and saw with amazement his eldest daughter.
"Louisa?"
"Father, I want to speak to you."
"What is the matter? How strange you look. And good heaven," said Mr. Gradgrind, wondering more and more, "have you come here exposed to this storm?"
She put her hands to her dress as if she hardly knew.
"Yes."
Then she uncovered her head, and letting her cloak and hood fall where they might, stood looking at him, so colourless, so dishevelled, so defiant and despairing, that he was afraid of her.
"What is it? I conjure you, Louisa, tell me what is the matter."
She dropped into a chair before him, and put her cold hand on his arm.
"Father, you have trained me from my cradle."
"Yes, Louisa."
"I curse the hour in which I was born to such a destiny."
He looked at her in doubt and dread, vacantly repeating,
"Curse the hour? Curse the hour? How could you give me life, and take from me all the inappreciable things that raise it from the state of a conscious death? Where are the graces of my soul? Where are the sentiments of my heart? What have you done, O Father? What have you done with the garden that should have bloomed once in this great wilderness here?"
She struck herself with both her hands upon her bosom.
"If it had ever been here, its ashes alone would save me from the void in which my whole life sinks. I did not mean to say this, but, Father, you remember the last time we conversed in this room?"
He had been so wholly unprepared for what he heard now that it was with difficulty he answered.
"Yes, Louisa. What has risen to my lips now would have risen to my lips then if you had given me a moment's help. I don't reproach you, Father. What you have never nurtured in me, you have never nurtured in yourself. But, oh, if you had only done so long ago, or if you had only neglected me, what a much better and much happier creature I should have been this day."
On hearing this, after all his care, he bowed his head upon his hand and groaned aloud.
"Father, if you had known when we were last together here, what even I feared while I strove against it, as it has been my task from infancy to strive against every natural prompting that has arisen in my heart, if you had known that there lingered in my breast sensibilities, affections, weaknesses capable of being cherished into strength, defying all the calculations ever made by man, and no more known to his arithmetic than his creator is, would you have given me to the husband who I am now sure that I hate?"
He said,
"No, no, my poor child. Would you have doomed me at any time to the frost and blight that have hardened and spoiled me? Would you have robbed me for no one's enrichment, only for the greater desolation of this world, of the immaterial part of my life, the spring and summer of my belief, my refuge from what is sordid and bad in the real things around me, my school in which I should have learned to be more humble and more trusting with them, and to hope in my little sphere to make them better? Oh, no, 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 Louisa.
Yet, Father, if I had been stone blind, if I had groped my way by my sense of touch, and had been free while I knew the shapes and surfaces of things to exercise my fancy somewhat in regard to them, I should have been a million times wiser, happier, more loving, more contented, more innocent and human in all good respects than I am with the eyes I have. Now hear what I have come to say." He moved to support her with his arm. She, rising as he did so, they stood close together, she with a hand upon his shoulder, looking fixedly in his face.
"With a hunger and thirst upon me, Father, which has never been for a moment appeased.
with an ardent impulse towards some region where rules and figures and definitions were not quite absolute.